Les colloques du Collège de France.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Peter Botari, so I will chair this morning session, and we have two presentations until the coffee break. The first presenter is Cécile Albert. I'm happy to introduce you. So she is a CNRS researcher at the Mediterranean Institute for Ecology and Environment in Aix. And Provence. I don't know, my pronunciation is not so good in French. After a training in plant functional ecology, she has investigated the combined effects of climate change and land use change, as well as how land use change can serve as a leverage for adaptation to climate change through land management and connectivity conservation. Her current research, belonging to landscape ecology, aims to disentangle the effects of habitat loss and fragmentation on biodiversity at different spatial and temporal scales. So, welcome, Cécile. The floor is yours.
Thank you, Peter. Thank you, Sandra, for the invitation, and thank you, everybody, for being here today. So, yeah, the question is habitat good? Is habitat connectivity good or bad for biodiversity? And I'm going to introduce you in recent progresses on this ongoing debate. So, as you know, habitat loss and fragmentation that are driven by many different human activities, such as logging or urbanization, are a key driver of biodiversity decline today. And for many years now, it has been said, and also lots of research has shown that it should be a good thing to go towards connectivity conservation to maintain ecological processes in landscapes. So for instance here, to make it possible for this squirrel to find a mate. But there is in the scientific literature an ongoing debate about the relative role of habitat fragmentation versus habitat amounts, and which of these we should prioritize in terms of habitat conservation to conserve biodiversity. And this debate, it emerges from this paper that has been published by Jared Diamond in 1975, in which he made the hypothesis that it would be better to protect a single large patch than to protect several small patches. And that's what has been named the sloth debate for single large versus several small. He also made the hypothesis that habitats that connected protected areas were better than non-connected protected areas, but these were only hypotheses that still had to be tested. And so for decades now, this is something that has been tested with various experiments, various modeling, and the thing is that there is still the debate, and there is still these papers that have been published quite recently that were saying that it could be bad or good for biodiversity to have habitat fragmentation. So namely the fact that, in fact, the habitat is separated in several patches and several blocks, and not a single large patch of habitat. So I prefer to rephrase it a bit differently. The question to me is rather how to best design landscapes for biodiversity conservation. And if we were looking at this graph here, we see that if we are losing habitat, we are interested in this green habitat here that can be forest or that can be grasslands. We know that the biodiversity which is associated to this habitat will decline as we are losing habitat, because here if we have no habitat left, then we won't have the species that are associated to this habitat anymore. So this tends to say that we should prioritize habitat amounts, because if we don't go toward this situation and we stay with higher levels of habitat, we should preserve biodiversity. So that's one side of the debate. But maybe there is this option that, in fact, there is here a kind of margin, and we are not losing drastically if we are still protecting for connectivity and the habitat which is remaining is at the same amount, but with a different spatial configuration. So that could say that, in fact, we should prioritize connectivity conservation that the other side of the debate. And there is also a third thing in this debate, which is generally less looked at, which is the management of the landscape matrix. Because in fact here, the white landscape matrix surrounding the habitat is really bad for the species associated to this green habitat. But we can imagine that we have something which is less harsh and which is better for the species in between the remaining habitats that can help lose less of these species that are associated to the green habitat. So that's the goal of the scale project that I led for the last years, to test the effects of habitat configuration and the matrix effects at fixed habitat amounts. So to do this, in fact, we are looking at this gray space range of possibilities here that is defined by habitat loss, and also something which is a measure of connectivity here, which is the amount of reachable habitat in the landscape, because we have some, for a given amount, we have some habitat that can be little fragmented with a high level of reachable habitat, and some that are highly fragmented that are really less good for the species. That's my hypothesis. So to do this, we tested this hypothesis for multiple study systems at different spatial scales. So miniland with Colombola in the lab with experimental systems, mesoland with artificial landscapes in the field following arthropod communities, and macroland where we followed the red squirrel in real landscapes. We studied different biodiversity facets and different ecological mechanisms like dispersal and movements, population dynamics and species interactions in order to disentangle these two effects of quantity and configuration. So the mesoland experiment occurs in La Croix in southern France. Here we set up these experimental landscapes that are 10 by 10 meter. They are fenced areas, so fenced for smaller crawling arthropods. We have 23 artificial landscapes that are ranging from 0 to 99% of habitat loss. And habitat loss is in fact, so the real habitat is stone cover here, which is totally natural, which is high. And here we removed and raked all the stones in between to make a matrix that is less good for the arthropods. And we have three fragmentation levels, so some patches that are still one big patch and some that are more like fragmented with different patches for the same amount of habitat. And we are following the arthropod communities with some dry pitfall traps like that. So what we found first of it in the first year was that our communities were dominated by spiders. We also had woodlouse, silverfish, beetles, harvestmen, and then a lot of other taxa, but with lower abundance. And what we observed is that the number of captured decreased with habitat loss. So here, in fact, we have the habitat loss in the landscapes, and here we have the number of animals captured in our pitfall traps, and it clearly declined, but there was no effect of fragmentation. And this decline was led by a quick response of habitat specialists with silverfish and woodlouse that were clearly declining with habitat loss. And interestingly, that was not due to the extreme landscapes in black here, because the relationship was still going on with only the red landscapes here. We found no effect on the taxonomic diversity, and we found also relatively consistent results for the subsequent years, so 2023 to 2025, and the experiment is still going on, so we have also new data for 2026. So then we also looked at it a bit differently, looking at the biomass in the pitfall traps. We used allometric equations from a paper from Solstrom et al. 2018. So in all pitfall traps, we took pictures and we measured the body length and body width of individuals. And with the allometric equations, we estimated individual biomass that we could aggregate at the pitfall trap level. And here we can see that the predicted biomass at the pitfall trap and the weighted biomass are very well correlated. So then we did that for all the data in 2024. And what we can see is that the total biomass is declining with habitat loss, which looks logical because we had less arthropods, a smaller number of captures. But in fact, it's also holding when we are dividing by the number of captured individuals. So on average, we are also capturing smaller individuals. And in fact, we are also capturing individuals from smaller species. So it suggests that there could be changes also in biotic interactions that were going behind, because in these systems, like, everybody is eating everybody. There are probably more complex things that are going on beside the number of captures. So Mesoland in brief, in fact, we observed quick decline of habitat specialists after habitat loss. We observed absolutely no effect of habitat fragmentation. But there are several things here. Maybe there is an importance of time after disturbance. So the more recent data don't suggest that. Maybe there is the question of the nature of the landscape matrix, because here the matrix is more a degraded habitat and then really a very harsh matrix. So maybe it's too good for the animals and it's not having such a strong effect that could have, like, urbanization or stuff like that. And maybe there is also a question of spatial scale, because in fact it was a huge deal to set up this experiment, but still landscapes are of a modest size, and so there could be something also of a size issue. And we observe no response of taxonomic diversity, but probably complex effects on biomass. And so the experiment is still going on. So there should be next results in the coming years, especially on animal trackings. So now in terms of macroland, here we looked at it a bit differently. So we were still interested in exploring this range of possibilities, but we focused on landscapes where we had a huge amount of habitat loss with different levels of fragmentation and also different matrix types. So we can see here the landscapes which shows, in fact, we have different urban areas in southern France and in northern France, and we have different rural areas also. And the idea was to compare gene flow in these landscapes of the red squirrel. And now we have a genotype more than 1,000 samples. So we have here samples collected with air tubes. Here is an example of the Aix-en-Provence study area. So we have areas where we have air samples for the squirrel. We have areas where it didn't work, this genetic analysis. We have areas where we didn't find any hairs, and we have also cadavers of squirrels from road sampling. And so one of the questions was, what drives genetic diversity in landscapes? So here we have a pool of individuals that were sampled closely, and we can imagine that the genetic diversity is related to the landscape around. So it can be related to different size of landscape, and it can be also related to different temporal scales, to the landscape, recent landscape or more older landscape, for instance. So what we observed with the real data is that, in fact, this genetic diversity is related to the landscape structure in the 1980s. And what we observed is also that it's related to the landscape structure at 14 kilometers for these buffers. And so in terms of the direction of the effects, what we observe is that here we have the local habitat amount, so the habitat amount around the squirrel sampled. And here we have the genetic diversity. And we can see that, in fact, if we have a lot of habitats surrounding the samples, we have a higher genetic diversity when it's fragmented, so higher number of patches. And when we have little habitat, we have a higher genetic diversity when we have fewer patches. So in fact, for this study system, what we see is that the best habitat spatial organization for this genetic diversity depends on habitat amount. So it's not one or the other, but it's the two of them together. And so we can ask the same questions regarding what drives genetic differentiation in the landscapes. So for instance, are these squirrels here closely related to these squirrels here, because what is in between is mainly forest, and are these squirrels here more genetically isolated because they are separated by urban areas or roads or stuff like that? And so we have not finished the analysis here yet, but what we can see just as a starter is that, so it's for the Aix-en-Provence study area, we have a genetic gradient. So these individuals that are blue, they are closer genetically speaking, and those individuals that are red, they are closer genetically speaking, and the blue ones are quite different from the red ones. And we, this first picture suggests that there might be two subpopulations or two groups at least that are separated by something. So now we have to find that something that might be related to the matrix in the landscape. So macroland in brief, so it was really a tedious sampling process because it took us 5 years to collect this data. But now we have an extensive database that suggests that there is an interactive effect of habitat amount and fragmentation on genetic diversity. We can see that the landscape effects on genetic diversity are visible at large spatial scales and large temporal scales. And the results also so far suggest there are effects of the landscape matrix, but we still have to analyze that concretely. So now for the last study system, we are looking at Miniland. So here we still have the same question and we investigated a given amount of habitat loss, but we really get into the details of different levels of fragmentation. But here fragmentation was not just a question of the number of patches, but more in terms of accessibility of the patches regarding the distance between the habitat patches and regarding the landscape matrix. So we used Folsomia candida, which is here this small arthropod, and we constructed mini landscapes that looked like that with habitat patches surrounding by a landscape matrix. So these artificial landscapes, they are 50 by 50 centimeters. We changed the interpatch distance for 10 different interpatch distances that were all within a range that was reachable by the individuals when they were moving on a good matrix. And we also changed the matrix with four different types. One that was good, they could move easily and reach easily everything. And then four other ones that were going towards a gradient. And one matrix that was really harsh and the individuals died super quickly on it. Then we released these arthropods in one habitat patch and we looked at colonization. So were they able to reach the other empty patches that were small boxes that were good for them with moisture and resource? Were they able to establish in these new patches? And were they able to have population dynamics and persistence across the weeks? So for these animals, weeks are generations. So here what we show is that the interpatch distance and the matrix resistance drive all important processes. So here an example on the colonization rates, what we can see that the number of colonized patch largely decline with increasing interpatch distance. And what we can see is that it declines not very quickly when we are on a good matrix and the individual can reach the patches that are far. But it declines very quickly when we are on the bad matrix, the felts, and the individuals don't even reach 10 centimeters. This also has an effect on mortality because they die much more quickly on the bad matrix than on the good matrix. There is an effect on natality, and overall, this leads to an effect on population size and even on extinction because on the bad landscapes, there are some extinctions after a few weeks. And what we found here is that, in fact, the population size in our landscape, at the landscape scale, were explained by the amount of reachable habitat really well. So here we have an increasing relationship. And what this means is that, in fact, in those landscapes where the habitat are close together and in a matrix which is like not really hard for the individual to cross, then we have large populations. In these landscapes that are intermediate, so it's either not easy to cross but close, or either easy to cross but far, then we have intermediate levels of population size. And when the amount of reachable habitat is really low, because it's either very hard to cross or it's less hard to cross but super far, then the population is small. So in addition to that, we also tested connectivity elements, and we showed that they can increase the amount of reachable habitat, but not in all cases. So here it was more or less the same experiment. We had the bad matrix here, and we added corridors of the good matrix, or stepping stones of the good matrix, or nothing. And we also tested like network setting, like just tubes that are connecting the habitat. And what we showed is that at short interpatch distances, corridors enhance movement rates, so it leads to a higher colonization success and to larger spatial distribution of the species. But at large distances, it also increased mortality of individuals. It reduced natality because there is a kind of trade-off between the movement and the natality. And it reduced population size overall. In addition, we saw that there are like differential effects of on demographic parameters because natality, recruitment, mortality, and also dispersal are all affected by the different landscape conditions. And we also observed strong discrepancies between the landscape settings here and the network setting that are completely different. So in terms of Miniland, what we learned is that with these small-scale experiments, it's easier to control, to have more repetitions, and also to really understand the processes that are behind because we can measure lots of things. Interestingly, that's miniature biological model, but the processes that are behind are the same because they are reproducing, they need resource, they undergo density-dependent processes, they have to move across the landscape. Importantly, our results also show that landscape approach and network approach can be really different and that we really need to be careful about that. And we found key effects of interpatch distances because interpatch distances conditions the mobility and the accessibility, but it goes with a key role of the landscape matrix, with strong effects of habitat configuration at fixed habitat amounts. So overall, we found that there is a strong, potentially a stronger effect of habitat amounts than of habitat fragmentation. There is an interactive effect of habitat amount and fragmentation, but we also found that matrix effects should be accounted for and that we really need to understand the effect on the processes because that's key to understand what's going on at the pattern level. So to me, how landscapes are actually functionally connected depends on habitat amount, matrix, permeability, spatial organization, species mobility, and dynamics, temporal legacies, and also spatial and temporal skills, and not just fragmentation. And this really changed, we should change the debate for something which is under what combinations of these factors does fragmentation produce which outcomes in terms of persistence and interactions and diversity. And so we also show that the amount of reachable habitat, not only the amount of habitat, but how reachable it is, explains population size, and that might be the way to go. So thank you for your attention, and I also thank all the people who contributed to this science.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr. Les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.